Hi, I'm Stan Brakhage, and today I want to introduce you to some of my friends, as usual. I'm going to tell you the story of how I met Robert Creeley. First of all, in the 60s, the most famous book of poetry that I was interested in reading and that also was being shared widely with the society around me was Robert Creeley's For Love. But long before that book came out, I'd been reading Creeley's poetry through friends, sometimes just receiving it in the mails, as was the ordinary way then and now again to receive new poetry in letters in the mail. I had never met him, so when I came back from a lecture tour, and Jane and the then three Brakhage children all met me at the train, and she told me that there was right at that instant a farewell party for Robert Creeley going on in Boulder, I determined to crash it. Now, I don't believe in crashing parties, and in fact, I never have before, and I haven't since. But this one we certainly crashed. Even though my face was covered with a stubble of beard and I was smarmy from 2 days on a train, and Jane was just there in a corduroy pullover, and the children were all dressed colorfully coming apart, as children usually are, especially the baby, you know, dropping diaper, etc. And this was a kind of formal party at a large, intimidating-looking house in Boulder where all the faculty had gathered together to meet and say goodbye to a poet, Robert Creeley, and his wife, Bobby, who was with him. Well, it does say something about the 60s that we were graciously received, even though we moved through that band of well-dressed-up people like the wildest gypsy parade you ever saw. And, but you see, it was just something I had to do. I had to meet him. I already loved him. And there might not ever be another chance. And then he and Bobby reached out to all of us. I mean, they were just delighted to see us, like they say. And we were some sight and embraced and were immediately close and have been really ever since. Within several weeks, I had arranged for Bob to make the recordings that you're about to hear, and I think they were the first actual studio recordings that he'd ever made of himself reading poetry. So here's a young Bob Creeley reading a poem that, by the way, later Jack Nicholson was to make a whole film based on, starring himself and directed by himself. a very famous poem at the time. But when Bob made it, he's just reading it to me in a little booth not unlike this one, in which I'm passing it on to you. Bob Creeley reading several poems from For Love.
I know a man. As I said to my friend, because I am always talking, John, I said, which was not his name, the darkness surrounds us. What can we do against it, or else shall we? And why not buy a goddamn big car? Drive, he said, for Christ's sake, look out where you're going. The warning. For love, I would split open your head and put a candle in behind the eyes. Love is dead in us if we forget the virtues of an amulet and quick surprise. A form of adaptation. My enemies came to get me, among them a beautiful woman. And God, I thought, this will be the end of me, because I have no resistance. Taking their part against me, even, flattered that they were concerned, I lay down before them and looked up soulfully, thinking perhaps that might help. And she bent over me to look at me then, being a woman. They are wise to send their strongest first, I thought, and I kissed her. And they watched her and both of us carefully, not at all to be tricked. But how account for love, even if you look for it? I trusted it. La noche. In the courtyard at midnight, the moon is locked in itself to a man, a familiar thing. The whip. I spent a night turning in bed. My love was a feather, a flat sleeping thing. She was very white and quiet, and above us on the roof there was another woman I also loved, had addressed myself to in a fit. She returned. That encompasses it, but now I was lonely. I yelled, but what is that? Ugh, she said beside me. She put her hand on my back, for which act? I think to say this wrongly. Juggler's thought. Heads up to the sky, people are walking by. In the land with no heads, tails hanging to trees, where truth is like an apple, reddened by frost and sun, and the green fields go out and out under the sun.
Most people get the news of love, of course, firsthand, or then with each other, or from popular songs, not from poetry. But the most ancient poems, the Chinese poems, the lyric poems about love, aren't all that different from, say, the love songs of the Alverne, as arranged by Joseph Cantaloupe and sung by Dobroth. I just give you an example. When I was a young girl, I tended my sheep, Tooraloo, etc. I had a spindle and got a shepherd, Tooraloo, to watch the flock. He wants one kiss, Tooraloo, but I am not ungrateful, and instead I give him two kisses. And the Tooraloos, of course, are about where words cease to have any meaning.
Oh,
two other lifelong friends, Ed Dorn and Jenny Dorn, long before they were collaborating and making Rolling Stock the greatest newspaper in the world, long before the kids even, they came on their long honeymoon to visit Jane and I at 9,000 feet in the mountains and stayed a while. And during that stay, Ed shared with us and allowed us to tape some songs that were then works in progress. And here's song two and song three from the mid-60s, late 60s, I guess.
Song two. Inside the late nights of last week, under the cover of ourselves, you went to sleep in my arms, and last night too. You were in some alarm of your dream, some tableau, an assembling of signs from your troubled day glows and trembles your limbs, divine with sleep, gather and extend their flesh along mine, and this I surround, all this I have my arms around, awake. Song three. My speech is tinged, my tongue has taken a foreignness into it. Can you understand? My uncertainties grow, an underbrush and thicket of furious sensibility between us, and wholly unlike the marvelously burning bush which lies at the entrance to your gated thigh. My dear love, when I unsheath a word of the wrong temper, it is to test that steel across the plain between us.
Gertrude Stein is very good at starting where most people are just superficial. And most people are pretty superficial when they first come upon each other with dreams of loving. A young man's fancy lightly, to be sure, turns in spring. Pigeons on the Grass, alas, is understandable if you realize that young ladies were then ordinarily called pigeons. It was a term like babies or whatever. And on the grass, that would make many women. But alas, the term lass goes way back and has a long dignity. And yet also, this is just a picture. Pigeons on the grass. Alas, as set by the composer Virgil Thompson in Four Saints and Three Acts.
Pigeons on the grass, alas.
Pigeons on the grass, alas.
Shot long the grass, shot longer, longer, shorter yellow grass. Pigeons, large pigeons on the shorter, longer yellow grass, alas. Pigeons on the grass.
If they were not pigeons, what were they?
If they were not pigeons on the grass, alas, what were they?
He had heard of a bird, and he asked about it.
It was a magpie in the sky.
If a magpie in the sky, on the sky, cannot cry. If the pigeon on the grass, alas, can alas. And to pass the pigeon on the grass, alas. And the magpie in the sky, on the sky, and to try, and to try. Alas, on the grass, alas, the pigeon on the grass, the pigeon on the grass, and alas.
They might be very well, very well, very well. They might be very well. They might be very well, very well. They might be.
I haven't quite figured out what the magpie in the sky is, but I suppose it would have something to do with what comes later, after the honeymoon. Gertrude Stein has a beautiful short story included in her long, gigantic book, The Making of Americans, which is really about that complication of love between parent and child. I don't know. The one leads to the other, but I often think we ought to have at least two words. Anyway, here's a little story of a father and his son, read by Gertrude Stein herself.
It happens very often that a man has it in him, that a man does something, that he does it very often, that he does many things, when he's a young man, when he's an old man, when he's an older man. One of such of these kind of them had a little boy, and this one, the little son, wanted to make a collection of butterflies and beetles, and was all exciting to him, and was all arranged then. And then the father said to the son, "You are certain this is not a cruel thing that you are wanting to be doing, killing things to make collections of them?" And the son was very disturbed then. And they talked about it together, the two of them. And more they talked about it then. And then at last the boy was convinced it was a cruel thing. And he said he would not do it. And his father said the little boy was a noble boy to give up pleasure when it was a cruel one. The boy went to bed then, and then the father, when he got up in the early morning, saw a wonderfully beautiful moth in the room. And he caught him, and he killed him, and he pinned him, and he woke up his son then and showed it to him. And he said to him, "See what a good father I am to have caught and killed this one." The boy was all mixed up inside him, and then he said he would go on with his collecting. And that was all there was then of discussing. And this is a little description of something that happened once, and it is very interesting.
There's a wonderful sense that Gertrude Stein has of just taking it flat. And in fact, though people have found her annoying in her repetitions, as they call them, she's insisted over and over again she doesn't repeat. And or, maybe more to the point, she said, people only really express themselves by saying the same thing over and over again. And if you think she's an odd, strange writer, just try listening, really listening, on your party line sometime to how people really do talk. Tennessee Williams, the American playwright, has also written a beautiful little poem that I think expresses, somehow all of it, the pain of the love between a mother and a child. He, of course, could get into the situation of the mother himself. He had in his play, The Glass Menagerie, by creating the character Amanda. He really could understand from both standpoints, and this tiny little poem, I think, shows it.
My little one whose tongue is dumb, whose fingers cannot hold things, who is so mercilessly young, he leaps upon the instant things. I hold him not, indeed, who could. He runs into the burning wood. Follow, follow, if you can. He will come out grown to a man, and not remember whom he kissed, who caught him by the slender wrist, and bound him with a tender yoke, which, understanding not, he broke.
You can't really do a program, as this seems to be, about love as it moves on, clear through children and into their breaking the yoke and moving into the burning wood, without, in fairness, dealing with the superego, which has to do with the strangest of all, that kind of abstract love for the whole world. Here's a statement by Sigmund Freud, who, after all, named the superego, which exhibits what it is so much. First of all, in German, he says, and I'm translating, "At 80 years of age, I left the people of the German nation, my home in Vienna, and came to England, where I hope to live the rest of my life." Now, that's in German, but, of course, he's forced out by the Nazis. Then comes this statement: "I started my professional activity as a neurologist trying to bring relief to my neurotic patients. Under the influence of an older friend and by my own efforts, I discovered some important new facts about the unconscious and the psychic life, the role of instinctual urges, and so on. Out of these findings grew a new science, psychoanalysis, a part of psychology. as the new method of treatment of the neurosis. I had to pay heavily for this bit of good luck. People did not believe in my facts and thought my theories unsavory. Resistance was strong and unrelenting. In the end, I succeeded in acquiring pupils and bringing up an international psychoanalytic association. But the struggle is not yet over. And he says, end quote, and he says that when he's, in 1938, when he's very close to death himself, a very old man and suffering terribly from cancer. I have the recording, which is hard to hear because of the prosthetic device in his mouth, which makes it both painful and difficult for him to speak. But he tries to express this as best he can in English. Here's the voice of Sigmund Freud.
Im Alter von 82 Jahren verließ ich infolge der deutschen Invasion mein Heim in Wien und kam nach England, wo ich mein Leben in Freiheit zu enden hoffe. I started my professional activity as a neurologist trying to bring relief to my neurotic patients. Under the influence of an older friend and by my own efforts, I discovered some important new facts about the unconscious in psychic life, the role of instinctual urges, and so on. Out of these findings grew a new science, psychoanalysis, a part of psychology, and a new method of treatment of neurosis. I had to pay heavily for this bit of good luck. People did not believe in my facts and thought my theories unsavory. Resistance was strong and unrelenting. In the end, I succeeded in acquiring pupils and building up an international psychoanalytic association. But the struggle is not yet over.
Finally, here's a poem that I think has it all. A father has had an argument with his son, and it tortures him very much and the whole family. And because he's a poet, he's able to turn that grief into some sense of the whole river that he and Celia and Paul, his wife and son, are. This is A11 with Louis Zukovsky reading.
A11 for Celia and Paul. River that must turn full after I stop dying. Song my song, raise grief to music. Light as my love's thought, the few sick, so sick of wrangling. Thus, weeping, sounds of light stay in her keeping, and my son's face. This much for honor. Freed by their praises who make honor dearer, whose losses show them rich and you no poorer. Take care, song, that what stars imprint you mirror grazes their tears. Draw speech from their nature a-loving you, face to your outer stars, purer gold than tongues make, without feeling art new, hurt old, revealing the slackened bow as the stinging animal dies, thread gold stringing the fingerboard pressed in my honor. Honor song sang the blessed is delight knowing we overcome ills by love. Hurt song nourish eyes, think most of whom you hurt. For the flowing river's poison where what rod blossoms flourish by love's sweet lights, and sing in them I flourish. No song, not any one power may recall or forget. Our love to see your love flows into us. If Venus lights, your words spin to live, our desires lead us to honor. Graced, your heart in nothing less than in death go. I, dust, raise the great hem of the extended world that nothing can leave. Having had breath, go face my son, say, if your father offended you with mute wisdom, my words have not ended his second paradise, where his love was in her eyes, where they turn quick for you two. Sick or gone, cannot make music, you said less than all. Honor his voice in me, the river's turn that finds the grace in you. Four notes first too full for talk, leaf lighting stem, stems bound to the branch that binds the tree. And then, as from the same root we talk, leaf after leaf of your mind's music page, walk leaf over leaf of his thought, sounding his happiness. Song sounding the grace that comes from knowing things, her love, our own, showing her love in all her honor.
And as usual, we end with Charles Ives, The New River, conducted by the composer Gunther Schuller, by the way.